The Theosophical Society presents Helen Zahara in a talk entitled Buddhist Sacred Literature.
Hello, everybody. 2,500 years ago, there walked upon the earth a great teacher, the Lord Buddha, who lived and preached a doctrine of peace and compassion, and demonstrated by his own life that suffering could be overcome by the renunciation of desire and the elimination of ignorance. Today, Buddhism is one of the world's great religions, and it's estimated that one-third of the population of the world profess to be its followers. Yet most of us in the West know very little of the vast mass of religious texts which have emerged from this religious movement, ranging from simple little homilies on the moral rules, through parables and stories, biographical episodes, to deep and abstruse philosophical concepts. Of course, I can only scratch the surface, yet even to do that can reveal a rich and varied panorama of wisdom and knowledge. This type of research is part of the second object of the Theosophical Society, which relates to the encouragement of the study of comparative religion, not simply as an academic exercise, but in an attempt to bring greater understanding between peoples of different creeds, and to foster the concept of the brotherhood of man without distinctions and barriers. It's very difficult indeed to speak generally about Buddhist sacred literature, since Buddhism is divided into various traditional schools, each with its own set of scriptures. There is no one Bible which can be held up as the only authoritative and sacred book, and the bulk of authoritative Buddhist writings is enormous, covering hundreds of thousands of pages. Nor is there any one collection of sayings of the Buddha himself, and there are many later accretions, since the Buddhist teachings were transmitted orally for 500 years or more after his death, and began to be written down only at the beginning of the Christian era. The Buddhist canon continues to grow all the time, although the period between the years AD 100 and 400 was the golden age of Buddhist literature. As far as present knowledge goes, the main stock of systematized Buddhist literature, in the original or in translation, is contained mainly in the Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan, and Chinese languages, although, of course, they were also translated into the languages of the countries to which Buddhism has spread. To give an idea of the enormous mass of writing, a complete Siamese edition of the Pali canon, which is restricted to one single sect, fills 54 huge volumes, without including the vast quantity of commentaries. The Chinese canon, in a recent edition, is said to consist of 100 volumes of 1,000 closely printed pages, while the Tibetan canon extends to 325 volumes. It's rather sad to think that, with one exception, not a single Buddhist work has been found within the borders of India, where this great religion was founded. The main reasons are that the study of its literature was confined to the ordained monks and novices resident in the monasteries, and the texts were never kept in the houses of the laymen. With the decay or destruction of the monasteries, the manuscripts were destroyed, and the Buddhist literature that is studied today comes from monasteries outside of India, Ceylon, Burma, Siam, and Nepal, and in translations from Tibet, China, and Mongolia. In a book published in 1956 by the Ministry of Information and Broadcasting, Government of India, entitled 2,500 Years of Buddhism, there's reference to a remarkable addition to our knowledge of Buddhist literature, which has been made by the discoveries of manuscripts in Central Asia and Tibet, belonging mostly to the 5th and 6th centuries AD, or to an earlier period. These manuscripts were preserved in stone chambers built under Buddhist monuments or monasteries, and in temples where they were meant to be worshipped only and not studied. These discoveries are said to have thrown a flood of light on the development of Buddhist literature and the languages in which it was written, particularly on some extinct Central Asian dialects into which some of the texts were translated. Buddhist literature may be divided broadly into two sections, the Hinayana or Southern School and Mahayana or Northern School, though there are further subdivisions which are too numerous to go into in any detail. As far as the Hinayana or Southern School is concerned, the teachings of the Buddha which have come through this channel have been re-examined and revised by 6 great councils. 4 took place before the Christian era, the last in about 29 to 13 BC, when the teachings were committed to writing for the first time. At the 5th council in Mandalay, Burma, in 1871, the texts were recorded on 729 marble slabs. At the 6th Buddhist World Council, which ended in Rangoon, Burma, in 1956, 500 monks were appointed to re-examine the texts of the Buddhist scriptures after a large corps of lay scholars had first edited versions in the Pali language and had made draft translations into Burmese. These texts fill 54 books totaling 14,800 pages. They were the 3 systematic collections of northern Buddhist literature called the Tripitaka, or the 3 baskets, known as the Book of Discipline, the Popular Book of Discourses, and the collection of books on abstruse philosophy based on psychological ethics. The Pali language in which these appeared is the name given to the common dialect called Prakrit, in which the Buddha is supposed to have spoken. It was derived from Sanskrit, the ancient classical language of India, and the Pali canon represents the earliest and most complete collection of Buddhist sacred literature. Of the Tripitaka, the first, the Book of Discipline, contained the rules laid down for the monastic order which the Buddha established, called the Sangha. The Book of Discourses, the second part, contained that part of the Buddha's teachings which were given to the people, his ethical teachings and discussions, questionings and explanations arising out of them, and out of circumstances that he met with in his daily life. These, then, are the main records of the life and teachings of the Buddha. Of the third classification of Buddhist literature, very little is known in the West, but it is said to be full of mysticism and to contain the deeper aspects of Buddhist philosophy. Coming now to the Northern School of Buddhism, or Mahayana as it is called, Mahayana literature means the great vehicle, and it is sometimes translated as the higher path. The concepts of this school are highly philosophical and have a certain mystical quality, as distinguished from the more psychological approach which the Southern teaching uses to a considerable extent. The main text on which the Northern teachings are based is called Prajnaparamita. Prajna means transcendent wisdom or understanding, and Paramita suggests an ultimate goal. And the title as a whole has been translated as the perfection of wisdom. It has also been translated as the wisdom which brings a person to the other shore. Northern Buddhism includes a large number of myths and stories, just as there are certain stories popular among the Southern Buddhists which are said to relate the previous lives of Gautama and are known as the Jataka stories. From this northern tree of Buddhism, there has flowered in Japan the particular branch called Zen Buddhism, which uses meditation of a particular type as the means of coming to illumination. Northern Buddhism also includes that branch, sometimes called Lamaism, which flourishes in Tibet and nearby countries, where the original teachings of the Buddha have become embroidered, and the ritual of worship is more embellished because of the mixture of Tibetan magic. When I was living in India, I paid a visit to Sikkim, the little mountain state between India and Tibet, and was able to visit some monasteries of the Tibetan branch of Buddhism. I learned that their scriptures are translations from original Sanskrit texts from India, and a few also from the Chinese, made mostly between the 8th and 13th centuries AD. These are usually printed from rudely carved wooden blocks with remarkably tough paper made from the inner bark of a shrub growing in the Himalayas. These Lamaist scriptures consist of 2 great collections, the canon and the commentaries. The canon, or the great code, called the Kagyu, or the translated commandment, extends to 100 or 108 volumes of about 1,000 pages each, comprising 1,083 distinct works. The bulk of this colossal Bible may be imagined from the fact that each of its 100 or more volumes weighs about 10 pounds and forms a package of about 28 inches long by 8 inches broad and 8 inches deep. This Kagyu is divided into three great divisions also, like the Tripitaka or three baskets which I've mentioned concerning the southern school of Buddhism. The discipline in 13 volumes, the sermons in 66 volumes, and the metaphysics, including transcendental wisdom, in 21 volumes. In addition, as I've mentioned, there is the Tibetan commentary called Kagyu. This is a great cyclopedic compilation by ancient Indian and Tibetan scholars in 225 volumes. Before opening one of the volumes and when replacing it, the monk holds the book reverently on his head, saying, "May I obtain the blessing of thy holy word." From all that I've said, you can see what a tremendous subject we are dealing with. While in the West there is an increasing interest developing in the Eastern religions, and there are appearing various new translations and anthologies of Buddhist texts, these by no means cover the vast mass of Buddhist sacred literature. It's no wonder, therefore, that we are so ignorant of the depth and extent of Buddhist thought, and only have a very superficial and often distorted understanding of its precepts. We find that the ancient Buddhist writers and compilers had considerable interest in the life of the Buddha, and there are five biographies in the Southern School of Buddhism in what is called the Pali Canon, as well as stray pieces in other texts. The legends which have been built up relating the life of the founder of Buddhism, in fact, form an important part of Buddhist belief. The various biographies describe with variation the main incidents in the Buddha's life, which are also immortalized in many frescoes and sculptures in India, Ceylon, and elsewhere. We might take as an example of the incidents which stand out the birth of the Prince Siddhartha. Edward Conce, in a recent book on Buddhist scriptures published as a Penguin classic, quotes from the work of the first century Indian poet Ashvaghosha, which depicts very beautifully the scenes of the sacred drama. And we find in the symbolical legend of the birth of the prince the idea of a miraculous birth, as in Christianity and in other religious traditions. Here are a few short extracts, and I quote, "There lived once upon a time a king of the Shakyas. He was pure in conduct, and he had a wife, splendid, beautiful, and steadfast, who was called the great Maya, from her resemblance to Maya the goddess. One day she conceived the fruit of her womb, but without any defilement. Just before her conception she had a dream. A white king elephant seemed to enter her body, but without causing her any pain. When the queen noticed that the time of her delivery was approaching, she went to a couch overspread with an awning, thousands of waiting women looking on with joy in their hearts. A son was born to the queen for the weal of the world. He came out of his mother's side without causing her pain or injury. His birth was miraculous." That's the end of that quotation. The biographical legends telling the life of the prince describe his life in his father's palace, surrounded by the luxury of the court, his marriage to the beautiful Yasodhara, and the birth of their son Rahula. In his youth, he is shielded from the sight of old age, illness, and death. But one day he drives out in his chariot, and then come the incidents which bring such a profound change in his future life. He meets an old man bowed down with years. He watches a dead man being carried to his cremation. He talks to a man stricken with disease, and he meets an ascetic who is serene midst the turmoil of life. These stir many questions in his mind for which he must find the answer. And so he begins his long search, leaving his riches, renouncing worldly possessions, and becoming an ascetic wandering in the forest. Finally, seated underneath the Bodhi tree at a place called Gaya in North India, he attains supreme enlightenment. Then in the deer park at Saranath, some distance away, he preaches his first sermon. Wandering and teaching for many years, He finally leaves his physical body at the age of 80 and reaches, as it is said, the state of peace and bliss, or nirvana, as it's called. Now, in the vast mass of literature built around these events, we find sayings of the Lord Buddha, parables relating to his life and teachings, and abstruse philosophical discourses. Among those which are most famous is, of course, the Buddha's first sermon. Its Pali name has been translated by one scholar as the setting in motion of the royal chariot wheels of the kingdom of righteousness, though it is very often briefly described in Buddhist books as the turning of the wheel of the law. It explains the great middle way of the Buddha, the life of perfect righteousness in the world, which lies midway between the extravagances of asceticism on the one hand and the carelessness of mere worldly life on the other. There are four noble truths enunciated in the sermon. These briefly are: 1. All manifested life is sorrow unless man knows how to live it. 2. The cause of sorrow is always desire. 3. The ceasing of sorrow comes through conquering love of self, helping others, and letting all selfish desires cease. The fourth noble truth is the way which leads to escape from sorrow, called the Noble Eightfold Path, describing 8 steps to be taken along the way. These are right belief, right thought, right speech, right action, right means of livelihood, right endeavor, right memory, and right meditation or concentration. Just as we have the 10 commandments in the Bible, we find the principal moral teachings of Buddhism summed up in 5 precepts, which are repeated by the faithful as follows. I undertake to observe the rule, to abstain from taking life, to abstain from taking what is not given, to abstain from sensuous misconduct, to abstain from false speech, to abstain from intoxicants as intending to cloud the mind. There are commentaries in the Buddhist canon enlarging on and explaining these precepts in detail. In the records also of the sayings of the Buddha, we find much moral teaching. Here, for instance, are a few extracts from a discourse by the Lord Buddha uttered in reply to a question as to what are the greatest blessings or the greatest good. This translation is by the Pali scholar Professor Rice Davies. And I quote, "Not to serve the foolish, but to serve the wise, to honour those worthy of honour, this is the greatest blessing. To support father and mother, to cherish wife and child, to follow a peaceful calling, this is the greatest blessing. To bestow alms and live righteously, to give help to one's kindred, to do deeds which cannot be blamed, this is the greatest blessing." After several more verses of similar vein, the exhortation concludes, "Invincible on every side is he who acteth thus. On every side he walks in safety, and his is the greatest blessing." Often the Buddha gave his teachings through simple and homely illustrations, as in this story. One of his followers, a Brahmin, asks him why it is that some of his disciples attain to liberation or salvation, nirvana as it's called, whilst others fail, when they all have had the Lord as their instructor. The exalted one then responds with a question to his follower. "Do you answer me this, my friend, so far as you think fit? Are you well skilled on the road to Rajagaha?" "I am, master. Skilled indeed am I in the road to Rajagaha." "Now how say you then, my friend? Suppose a man should come up to you and say, 'Sir, I would go to Rajagaha, show me the way.' Then suppose you say to him, 'All right, my man, this is the road to Rajagaha. Go on a bit, then you'll see a village, call so-and-so. Go on a bit further and you'll see such and such a suburb. Go a bit further and you'll see the delightful landscape, the delightful lotus pond of Rajagaha.' Well, thus instructed by you, he takes the wrong road, and off he goes with his face set to the west. Then a second man comes up with the same request, and you give him the same instructions. He follows your advice and comes safe to Rajagaha. Now, friend, what is the reason? What is the cause? Here we have Rajagaha. Here we have you as instructor. But after all your advice and instructions, one man took the wrong road and went west, while the other men got safely to Rajagaha. And then the Brahmin replies, "Is that my business, master? I am just the shower of the way." And then says the exalted one, "Well, my friend, here we have nirvana, liberation. Here we have the way to it, and here stand I as instructor of the way. Yet some of my disciples, thus advised and trained by me, do attain the goal, and others do not attain. What do I in the matter? I am the one who shows the way." That's the end of that story. In some of the Buddhist texts, we discover how sometimes the Buddha put very profound and abstruse teachings in amazingly simple terms. Here's the very ancient philosophical concept that man himself, the microcosm, is a reflection of the universe, the macrocosm. The Lord said, "My friend, in this very body, 6 feet in length, with its sense impressions and its thoughts and ideas, I do declare you as are the world, and the origin of the world, and the ceasing of the world, and likewise the way that leadeth to the ceasing thereof." From the very few brief examples which I've given, we can see why the Buddha's teachings have meaning and appeal for millions of his followers, and they are still as alive and vital as when he uttered them 2,500 years ago. This evening, I would like to speak about a famous collection of verses known as Dhammapada, which it is suggested belongs to the world's literature. It is a small manual of Buddhist teachings which contains ideas of universal appeal and has considerably literary merit. The name Dhammapada comes from the Pali words Dhamma, discipline, law, religion, and Pada, the path or way. So it means the path of virtue. It is an anthology of 423 verses written in Pali, the Indo-Aryan language of the Buddha's times, and the verses are attributed to the Buddha himself as thoughts spoken during his years of wandering when he preached the law of righteousness. Though it forms only one minute part of the total Buddhist canon, it covers the essential principles of Buddhist philosophy and the Buddhist way of life. The collection of verses is arranged according to topics into 26 chapters. It's often learnt by heart by young monks in Buddhist countries, and its verse form makes it easy to commit to memory. As has been mentioned many times in this session, part of the objects of the Theosophical Society is to encourage the study of comparative religion and philosophy, not only as an academic pursuit, but with the idea that a sympathetic understanding of people's religious beliefs and practices is surely necessary if we are to provide any basis of understanding upon which the brotherhood of man may be built. In this connection, it's interesting that theosophists have been connected with at least 3 translations which have been made of the Dhammapada into English. The first of these was during the years 1886 to 1889, when Colonel Alcott, president founder of the Theosophical Society, sent another member, C.W. Leadbeater, who later became well known in the movement, to manage a number of schools in Ceylon which were under the direction of the Buddhist Theosophical Society. In 1888, he began the publication of a weekly journal called The Buddhist, and he wrote to the Theosophical Society's international vice president, A.P. Sinnett, who was then in London, to ask Mr. Sinnett if he would approach Sir Edwin Arnold, the well-known author of The Light of Asia, for some contribution. Sir Edwin Arnold then translated the first chapter of the Dhammapada, The Footsteps of the Law, in poetic style. Here are some verses from that translation. "Thought in the mind hath made us. What we are by thought was wrought and built. If a man's mind hath evil thoughts, pain comes on him as comes the wheel the ox behind. All that we are is what we thought and willed. Our thoughts shape us and frame. If one endure in purity of thought, joy follows him as his own shadow, sure. He hath defamed me, wronged me, injured me, abased me, beaten me. If one should keep thoughts like these angry words within his breast, hatreds will never sleep. He hath defamed me, wronged me, injured me, abased me, beaten me. If one shall send such angry words away for pardoning thoughts, hatreds will have an end. One of the best-known translations of Buddhist sayings has been made by F.L. Woodward, a Pali scholar, who was for many years a member of the Theosophical Society and acted for a time as librarian at the Society's famous Adyar Library at its world headquarters near Madras in India. This collection has been published in the World Classics series by Oxford University Press. Here's an extract from that work taken from the Dhammapada, in which the Lord teaches how the wise may free themselves from the wheel of birth and death. They who yield to their desires down the stream of craving swim, as we see the spider run in the net himself hath spun. Wise men cut the net and go, free from craving, free from woe. Loose all behind, between, before, cross thou to the other shore. With thy mind on all sides free, birth and death no more shalt see. In 1956, at the time when the 2500th anniversary of the Lord Buddha was being celebrated throughout the Buddhist world, the Theosophical Publishing House brought out a new translation of the Dhammapada made by Dr. C. Kunan Raja, who was then professor of Sanskrit at the Andhra University in India. Dr. Kunan Raja was for some years director of the Adyar Library, which I've already mentioned, and he dedicated his translation to the memory of Dr. Annie Besant, with whom he was associated during the time that she was president of the Theosophical Society. The small book has a foreword by Sri Sri Prakasha, also a prominent theosophist in India, who was at the time governor of the state of Madras. As the foreword points out, the book tells with simple, homely illustrations and similes how we should conduct ourselves towards our fellow men, how hatreds will not cease by hatred, how they will cease by love alone, how scrupulous consideration is essential for the requirements and feelings of brother men. Listen then to these verses from Dr. Kunan Raja's translation. If there be a thousand speeches consisting of words without a meaning, a single word with meaning is better, hearing which one becomes tranquil. If there be a thousand songs of praise consisting of words without a meaning, a single word of a song of praise is better, hearing which one becomes tranquil. And he who may conquer in battle men in thousands and thousands, conquering his one self, he indeed becomes the greatest of conquerors. Then there are lines taken from some verses on flowers and fragrance. Just like a beautiful flower having colour and no fragrance, so a speech sweetly spoken becomes fruitless for one who does not do accordingly. It may be sandal paste or incense, or it may be water lily or jasmine. The fragrance of good conduct has no superior among the collections of such perfumes. This fragrance, which is in incense and in sandal paste, is just a small thing, and that fragrance that is in people with good conduct, that wafts as the best among the gods. This little book, like many other Buddhist works, condemns all kinds of sacrifice and the ascetic practices of self-mortification, and its main stress is on good conduct stabilized by concentration and strengthened by sound reasoning. As one commentator says, the teaching of the Buddha in a nutshell is, abstain from all evil, accumulate what is good, and purify your mind. And which religion wouldn't agree with this? According to this teaching, all compound things are transitory, full of suffering, and consequently incapable of being called one's own. Greed, ill will, and delusion are considered as dangerous as fire, and unless they are held in check, it is not possible to attain a happy life. What is so attractive about the Dhammapada, as many other sayings attributed to the Buddha, is how it abounds in appropriate similes which touch the heart. While recommending to a Buddhist monk a spotless life and a life of non-interference in the politics of a town or village, it says, "It's better for a monk to eat a red-hot iron ball than to live a life of non-restraint. The monk should go to a village to take his food and go away without meddling in the affairs of the town, just like a bee that goes to the flower, sucks the honey but does not harm to the colour or smell of the flower." A man who reads much good literature, but never tries to bring it into practice, is compared with a cowherd who counts the number of cows that go to a pasture under his care, but has no proprietary right in any of them. A man who becomes entangled in his own doings is compared to a spider who finds itself enmeshed in its own web. Many of the verses in the Dhammapada have application for all of us, both in the East and West, whatever may be our faith or belief. In fact, they're almost like proverbs. For instance, it's easier to do evil and harmful things than to do good and salutary things. There are only a few people in this world who have an insight. Most of them are blind. One should never belittle evil things, saying that they will never affect one. A water jar becomes, in the course of time, full by constant dripping. It's so easy to see the faults of others, but not so easy to see one's own. The smell of flowers goes only with the wind, but the fame of good men goes even against the wind. It's because of such gems as those which I've read that the Dhammapada has such wide appeal, and it brings to us in a very simple form some of the deep and abiding truths which the Buddha enunciated. Even if our reading of the Buddha's text doesn't go beyond that, we shall realize something of the beauty and wisdom of his teaching. We hope you've enjoyed this series on Buddhist texts. We present them in the spirit of the first object of the Theosophical Society, which embodies the principle of universal brotherhood, without such distinctions as race or color, and, of course, of creed. Good evening, everybody.